basically because of the advent of two rather unexpected serendipitous consequences. One of them involving a drug that we had on the shelf as pharmacists that was being marketed for the control of a condition known as trigeminal neuralgia. That drug being carbamazepine or tegretol. The other, a solvent that had been used since the 50s, actually, but was being used as part of a solvent system for screening some anti-epileptic agents, screening for some potential anti-epileptic agents in the early 70s, and it was found to have activity, and that substance was known as valproic acid. Now, what I need to do at this point is just indicate to you that not only were we having some, how would I say it, some light bulbs turning on, some enlightenment in the idea of treatment, that is, molecules that could be useful as drugs. But it was at about the same time that our sophistication in terms of neurophysiology got to the point that we started having some advances in mechanism of action, if you will, and other areas within the anatomy and physiology of the central nervous system that helped us out in terms of epilepsy. And one of them was this little chart in the upper right-hand corner. We got enough experience with electroencephalograms that we, on enough people, that we started finding a pattern. And that pattern is depicted here. It's called a 3-per-second spike and wave pattern. And this pattern is almost prima facie evidence of petit mal epilepsy. It's the greeting card, the hallmark for the condition. There is the rare case of a individual suffering from petit mal without this being present. But almost universally, if this is found somewhere within the electroencephalogram, there's a petit mal issue happening. And so, while I use this as the example, there are some other not as significant examples of advances where we got better at discriminating between these various types of conditions, where our ability to accurately diagnose into whatever type of epilepsy the individual was suffering from got a lot better. Now, trust me, with a grand mal seizure, and you've got the sheet in front of you that says what happens during a grand mal seizure. If a person has a grand mal seizure, most people could say, that's a grand mal seizure. Okay, but a lot of the other types of epilepsy tend to be a lot more subtle in terms of differences. And yet we were able, with some of our diagnostic abilities, to be able to start deciding the shades of gray and make more accurate diagnosis and maybe help in terms of our total treatment. So that while this is not a memorizing thing, what I'm saying is we were able to say, yeah, a person has this particular type of epilepsy according to the chart that we have produced. Now, back to these two drugs. Carbamazepine. Carbamazepine, an aminosilbene, tegretol, in a nutshell, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. If you want to put it in a fairly succinct phrase, it would be works ex- no, used exactly like phenytoin. Almost a carbon copy, almost a clone of phenytoin. While its use is the same, its side effect profile tends to be a little bit different. And so if you run into issues with phenytoin, you go to this. If you run into issues with this, what do? Go to phenytoin. This is one half of the other. Now, what are some issues with chronic treatment with Tegretol that were somewhat unexpected, I guess? Tegretol produces an antidiuretic effect, particularly in patients with a low ADH level, and low levels of antidiuretic hormone. Now, next semester, when we start talking the endocrine system, let me just say that most of you probably already know, well, all of you should already know, it's a question of whether you remember it at this point, that ADH, antidiuretic hormone, is a modern name, a newer name for the substance we used to call vasopressin, a hormone from the posterior pituitary. Are you with me so far? ADH, okay? The condition where there are lower than normal levels of ADH, you know, if you don't have antidiuretic hormone, what do you got? Diuresis, you know, is known as diabetes insipidus. And so individuals with low levels of ADH, this drug is capable of raising those levels back to normal, and it will also mildly elevate normal ADH levels. It has been tried in ADH. In diabetes insipidus, we got better ways to deal with that, but we'll talk about that next semester. It does have the ability to increase or produce antidiuretic effects in low ADH. That's kind of a eating in. Let's talk about some more major issues. One of the metabolites of carbamazepine is a compound that is, first of all, let me just say that this stuff gets metabolized quite a bit, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It's a compound that is generally termed an epoxide. And epoxides are very reactive molecules. And what happens is this epoxide turns around and starts interacting with other constituents within that liver cell, within that liver tissue. And so carbamazepine has the capability, at least, of being very toxic to the liver. excuse me. This can be exacerbated. Alcohol in excess, other things, a lot of acetaminophen being taken, anything that's really hard on the liver in its own part can exacerbate the problems with carbamazepine and vice versa. It does have some ability to suppress bone marrow activity, causing a condition that we term agranulocytosis. And just as an aside, and I'll dwell on this more next semester as well, if I were to ask, or if any professor were to ask on the test, quiz, or what have you, we've got drug X. What is the most common side effect or toxicity associated with drug X? What would be the standard bullshit answer? What? Mumble, mumble. What? Somebody yell it out. What's the standard bullshit answer? No, I see a vomiting. I don't know what the most common side effect is, so what am I going to write down? Nausea, vomiting. Okay. But second in line is agranulocytosis. When we talk about blood formation and drugs associated with that next semester, I had not a sheet. You know, but all the drugs that can produce agranulocytosis, it's expensive. But this one does it in spades, carbamazepine. So between the liver issues and bone marrow suppression and agranulocytosis, with chronic, again, administration, we can get into real problems with this substance. It also tends to produce the characteristic eye problems that I talked about with phenytoin and phenobarbital, double vision, nystagmus, those types of issues. And there have been some studies that have shown it to be carcinogenic. And this is probably, again, related to reactive metabolites like this epoxide. Mostly a liver carcinogenicity. Also in other areas as well. Carbamazepine. Now the other drug, the other substance to become a drug that I talked about is this one. Seven carbon iso whatever, carboxylic acid, that's what it is. That's valproic acid. Seven carbon and you got the carboxylic function coming off of the middle carbon. Very different structure, and yet has some anti-epileptic activity. Its trade name is Defaquine. Hopefully it's a no-brainer to suggest that if we try and put an oral formulation of this together, it's an acid. And with chronic administration, we see all sorts of GI problems cropping up. So it didn't take us long, probably longer than it should have, but it didn't take us long to understand that maybe we ought to try something else besides administering acid. So we've put together a formulation of not only the base compound, but also the sodium salt. And that combination, which tended to be more popular, is called Depakote. And again, it's there to lower the incidence and severity of upper GI distress, which it does rather well in most instances. A couple of things about this compound. It tends to have a slow onset of activity when compared to the other anti-epileptic drugs. Okay? Sometimes as much as 2 weeks. Not exactly sure why at this point, but it does happen. So you can't give up on it after a few days. If the incidence doesn't start going down or whatever, don't give up on the drug. Don't have your patients give up on the drug. It's highly protein bound, about 92 to 94%, So there tends to be quite an ability for drug interactions with this compound, as with a lot of the anti-epileptics, but it tends to be a problem. Now, on the downside, it tends to produce drowsiness, stupor, and confusion. In most individuals. So until a person goes through that two-week period and we get some rather consistency in blood levels and we determine what our effect is going to be, and people get used to it, we really have issues with like driving and machinery and all those kinds of issues. And particularly, you don't start taking alcohol or anything like that. While you're trying to get acclimated to this drug. The interesting thing is that rarely, I guess is the word I want to use, unusually it will produce excitement rather than drowsiness and stupor. And even tremor and seizure. So, excuse me, at that point, the neurologist is going to make the big money, earn his or her keep, because we have to make a decision now, is the seizure, or is the seizure the drug? Okay? Tends to be rather rare, but it can happen. Some tendency toward hair loss, which tends to be disconcerting and tends to work against compliance, particularly in females. I need to be gender specific here, but who gives a shit about hair loss? Right? That kind of issue. The other thing is it tends to be mildly hypotensive. So we have to watch the addition of hypotensive agents there. But the other thing is that there tends to be an incidence of liver failure associated with this drug. The incidence of this liver failure is placed at around 1 in 50,000. So it's not really common, let's put it that way. It's usually what is known as a fulminant hepatitis. Fulminant kind of means a kind of a snowball rolling downhill. Rock gathering moss, I don't care what kind of analogy, it tends to grow on itself. The risk has two factors associated with it. Risk tends to be much greater if you're under 10 years of age and have taken the drug chronically, and if the valproic acid is part of a polypharmacy approach. That is, there's multiple anti-epileptic drugs being utilized. One reason why valproic acid, at least, is used pretty much monotherapy at this point in time. Now, these two drugs, carbamazepine comes to the U.S. market in 74. And valproic acid in 78, Depakote a year or two later. And then we see this kind of chart develop. Okay? And you'll notice now that for the most part, we've talked about the drugs of choice, the initial drugs that are utilized for most of the, I won't say major, but it, yeah, I will say major. I mean, this accounts for probably 90%+ of the cases of epilepsy. These things on the left, these four or five major categories that I talked about. The two types of generalized seizures, common here in the middle, partial seizures, whether they be simple partial or complex partial, up toward the top. Okay. And you'll notice that over on the right, a lot of other names. These start coming on the market in about 1991 or 92. We've got about a 10-year span here, maybe 12, where nothing exciting in the chemical market happens, but a lot starts happening in the what do we know about epilepsy market in terms of mechanism of action. First of all, let me just say that there are two major forms of partial seizure that I've listed on that front sheet for you. Jacksonian or parafocal cortical, which tends to be, as the name implies, a problem in the cortex. Focal cortical seizures tend to show no alteration of consciousness. For sure, there's no loss of consciousness. Remember I said there's that argument as to whether there's alteration or not. This is one of them. Most people would say no alteration of consciousness. It's usually kind of a Parkinsonian, you know what Parkinson's disease is, right? It's kind of this kind of shaking, and it's usually unilateral. It's usually just one limb. Doesn't necessarily have to be the arm. It can be the leg. But it's usually a motor cortex problem, and it's usually localized there. Simple partial. And then we sometimes see what's called complex partial. This is what I've got listed on that front sheet as psychomotor. Okay? Behavioral changes, much more an issue in this. There's some impaired consciousness in the fact that the person tends to kind of space out, kind of like with an absence seizure, a petit mal. Now, petit mal is just kind of a quick spacing out. It may last a second or two at the most. The complex partial, it tends to be a little bit longer, but the way you can identify it is that there tends to be some sort of unusual behavior, commonly involving the mouth. Tongue may move around where you can see it outside. There may be lip smacking. Those types of behaviors. And that's the complex type. But generally speaking, both types, these major types of partial seizures, tend to be helped by the same things and drugs. So we got a little bit more knowledge there as to what we were looking for in separation in terms of what a partial seizure is. But the other thing that we discovered during this period was mechanism of action. Now we had, I don't want to phrase it, we had a fairly good idea what was going on, but we really didn't know. Now we do know, and we saw a lot of the new drugs that have developed based on this. And, you know, I probably oversimplified. I said we do know, right? Right? You know what I just said? I went along. We think we know. How's that? Here we go. Three mechanisms of action. Okay? like I said, we had a pretty good idea that what we were dealing with when we talk about epilepsy was high-frequency, spasmodic types of action potentials running down through neurons. And so it didn't take a rocket scientist to understand that perhaps what we were doing was slowing down action potential ability. And what would be an easy way to do that? Well, the channel. And this would be sodium channel. You know, what causes something to depolarize? Sodium channel activation. And so if we can slow down the ability of sodium channels to activate, slow down the numbers of action potentials running through, we should be able to negatively impact epilepsy. I mean, that thought has been around since I was sitting in UC across the street in Science Building. Okay? And in fact, a number of these drugs do. Basically, the phenobarb-phenytoin carbamazepine drugs, this is one of their mechanisms of action. Important to understand, what we're talking about is a modification of the channel from the outside. This isn't local anesthesia revisited. And we're probably not directly plugging the channel because we're not eliminating it, we're just slowing down its ability. And what's interesting again is that these drugs will slow it down enough to negatively impact epilepsy while only minimally impacting normal high-speed firing. And one of the things that requires normal high-speed firing is, in fact, coordination. Remember I talked about negative impact on speech with my phantoin? Well, we're right at that kind of threshold where we're doing well with epilepsy, but we're kind of, you know, negatively impacting some of those high-speed firing issues. The other thing besides coordination would be cognition that may just be slightly negatively impacted. But, you know, while it hasn't directly affected me, well, maybe in a way with those headaches I have, but most people suffering from epilepsy will take a little slowness in cognition or a little speech problem as opposed to grand mal seizures. I mean, that tends to be a no-brainer. Yeah, I'll take the problem. I'll stay on the drug. Okay? So, and sodium channel issue tends to be a mechanism of action. But in addition to that, as we started looking at it, we started finding perhaps a mechanism of action being an increase. Did I just go through puberty? an increased inhibition. And how do we do that? How do we increase our inhibition? Well, we started finding out in the early 80s that the best way to do that is those damn A receptors. Chloride channel. And some of the drugs, we think, act like benzodiazepines. That is, now wait a second, don't do this. I didn't say they are benzodiazepines. In the fact that they act at a benzodiazepine receptor, they act like like benzodiazepines. Perhaps there are other receptors on that GABA-A complex. You know, drugs that act on benzodiazepine receptors like zolpidem or whatever, they act like benzodiazepines. They're sedative hypnotics. But perhaps there are other receptors where we get anti-epileptic effect. Now, some of these drugs act that way, directly on the receptor. Others act to increase GABA levels indirectly. They either increase synthesis of GABA or decrease its destruction. They do something to modify GABA levels. They act indirectly to enhance inhibition. And finally, and one that was that's kind of interesting, is the discovery of an intrinsic property of thalamic neurons. This is known as the T current, and it's a voltage regulated. It tends to be responsive to certain voltage, and it is calcium ion mediated. Okay, and it tends to be kind of an amplifier for neuronic firing into the thalamus. I may have indicated it before, but one of the things that tends to take a seizure from local to generalized is getting into that central area in the forebrain, where the thalamus is a prominent structure. And the thalamic T current tends to be a key in terms of petimol activation. It's calcium ion mediated, not sodium, calcium tends to be the amplifier here. And we've discovered that compounds that are going to be effective against petimol universally modify, depress, down, whatever, calcium ion channels. They negatively impact calcium ion channels in the central nervous system, either directly or indirectly. And so this has become a common mechanism of discovery for these newer agents is what do they do to the T current. So we've got at least three mechanisms potentially for anti-epileptic action. And how a compound is going to be effective, that is, what types of epilepsy might it be useful for, will depend upon which of these three, and maybe it's got more than one, which of these three mechanisms of action it possesses. But discovering these mechanisms of action led to a rethinking, reinvigoration of drug discovery, if you will. And so, as I suggested, we've got a number of new agents that have come about since the early 1990s. And we're going to go through a few of them. Understanding or realizing, if you will, that despite all of this activity, and I'm talking probably 92 or 93, so we're talking 15 years now with all of these drugs, and there's probably like eight of them now that are fairly discrete molecules, none of them are in this column. Okay? None of them are in this column. They're either used as adjunct therapy in addition to with the understanding that if you, in addition to valproic acid, you're running a real risk, right? I just talked about that. But they're usually used either as adjuncts in addition to, or they're used as the column suggests, alternatives, last line, nothing here works, so why don't we try applesauce? What the heck, it can't hurt. Okay, so we go to these second line drugs. But we'll go through them, because the interesting thing is our ability now to pick up on these alternative mechanisms of action, and our understanding that we can think outside of the box. First of these is 12 of 1993. Gabapentin or Zerontin. Was used as a first-line agent against partial seizures. It increases GABA release within the central nervous system, so it indirectly works on GABA. Because it doesn't do anything with sodium channels, it has minimal upset on these normal high-speed voltages that we are firing, frequencies that we would like to keep. So that is not a problem. Has nothing, no effect on the T current, calcium-gated channels. So it's pretty much a GABA type of drug. Okay. The problem is that, as you might suspect, what did I say its mechanism of action is? Coordination. That was one 30 years ago, I'd love to say. Okay. Increased GABA release. Well, like with any neuronal drug that works with release, what's got to be there to release? The low, and sometimes you can run out. That is, we can develop intolerance. And as a result of that, it has now become basically adjunctive in therapy rather than a first-line drug. It's added to other drugs. And basically, it's added to other drugs that have a different mechanism of action, namely sodium channels, to try and add a little bit in the way of therapeutic efficacy. Also 12 of 1993. Substance felbamate. Felbitol. Felbitol also used for a number of different seizure types. Its main utilization was in partial seizures and myoclonic seizures, as you can see here. And the issue with felbamate was it was on the market for about 6 months. All right, it has started being used, was being used in about 100,000 patients at that point in time. And after 6 months, we had 10 cases of liver failure, and we had 10 cases of aplastic anemia. Four of which were fatal in each case. So we had 8 deaths, 20 cases. talking more extensively about this next semester. What we are doing is depressing bone marrow. Mild depression leads to a loss of white cell elements. We call that agranulocytosis. Moderate depression of bone marrow function says we're going to lose across the board. Everything's depressed. Not only the granulocytic, you know, the neutrophil, eosinophil types of things, but now we're going to be depressing platelet numbers, and we're going to be depressing red blood corpuscle numbers. Everything's down. That's pancytopenia. Moderate marrow depression. Severe marrow depression says zero, no formation, aplastic. Okay? Everything's zero. Nothing coming out of the bone marrow in the way of new cells or new corpuscles or new nothing. Okay? Aplastic anemia is no laughing matter. That's dead if you don't do something about it. Okay? As a result, felbamate was taken off of the market for a short period of time. And in late 1994, it was placed back on the market with severe restrictions. Basically, in plain English, the restriction was, don't use it if there's anything else in the world that works. We talk about first-line drugs. What's felbamate? The last-line drug. In the United Kingdom, a doctor putting an individual on felbamate has to register that individual. As to say, here's the individual patient, here's what I've tried, and doesn't work, and the person's having all sorts of problems with seizures. We got to do something. It's either this or anesthetize them for the rest of their life. Let's try felbamate. So that tends to be an issue. Okay? I'll just go through one more real quick. Compound called lamotrigine, lamictal. It comes on the market in a year later, in December of 94. This compound is a sodium channel compound. But again, it tends to be useful mainly in adjunct therapy as opposed to primary therapy. The best thing to say about it is, and I don't know whether it shows on this chart or not, but it tends to be very similar to carbamazepine in its therapeutic applications, but not nearly as efficacious. Useful as an alternative to carbamazepine if we start seeing some of those toxicities that I talked about earlier. All right, I will see you on Wednesday.